you ever feel as though your actions have been overlooked, your good deeds have gone unrewarded, the things that you've tried to do for other people, that you've worked so hard to bless them and to encourage them or to help them in differing ways, seem to be completely ignored? Do you ever feel that way? Feel the frustrations that it brings? Perhaps even in your workplace, the promotion that you had hoped for and longed for has been given to another, and you've been overlooked despite your best efforts to impress the boss. In all sorts of areas of life, we can feel as though we're not being treated the way we deserve to be treated. Now, in this passage that we have before us in Esther and chapter 6, we see of the way that that Mordecai was preferred, how he was advanced, how he was promoted in the king's eyes. But it refers to something that had taken place years earlier, something that had been completely overlooked. Let's have a look at this passage before us. You'll remember from last week how Haman, the arch enemy of the Jews, the villain of our story, had gone to bed a happy man. He had been honoured by the king. He had been honoured by the queen. He and the king were the only people to be invited to a banquet that Queen Esther had prepared. This was a great honour for Haman, and he had rubbed his hands in delight, and he had gone home afterwards and told all his family and his friends about how great he was to have been singled out in this way. Out of all the princes of Persia, the Queen Esther had honoured him along with the king in this wonderful way. But there was a sore point. There was this Jew who worked in as a magistrate, as it were, in the king's gate. Every time Haman went into the king's palace, every time he came out of the king's palace, he had to pass Mordecai, who refused to pay homage to him, who refused to honour him in the way that Haman felt he deserved. And so his wife and his friends advised him, why don't you build a gallows and have him hung on them? Get rid of him. He's on death row anyway. He's a Jew. You've already plotted against the Jew. The king's decree, which cannot be undone, is against them. In a few months' time, they'll all be dead. But why don't you just get rid of this thorn in your side? Get it out of the way. Have done with him. Build a gallows. Go tomorrow morning. Ask the king, and I'm sure that he will bless you after all. You're so privileged. You're so honoured. You've been advanced so highly. No doubt the king will allow you to execute this man who is distressing you so much. And Haman was so pleased. He had the gallows made, and we can imagine him sleeping soundly with a smile on his face. Meanwhile, in the palace, a restless king. He cannot sleep. For some reason, sleep has been taken away from him. And so he commands that the book of the records of the Chronicles, all the events that have taken place, a list of those that he has honoured, the things that have been done in his kingdom, is being read to him. It's calculated, he thinks, to send him to sleep. But it doesn't work that way. Instead, he finds something written about Mordecai, a Jew who saved his life. And what's more, nothing has been done to honour this man who saved his life. No dignity has been bestowed upon this Jew who told of the plot that was against the king. And so the king wants to honour him. Herodotus, who was a contemporary of Mordecai and Esther, writing at the time, a Greek historian, tells us that in Persia it was a matter of great importance that a king should honour anyone who has done them a favour. It was considered a terrible misfortune for a king to ignore someone. And so this king, he's reading in these records, he hears about Mordecai, and the narrator, as he's reading these records, presumably just passes on to the next event, and the king says, hold on, what was done for Mordecai? How was he honoured? What did I do for this man who saved my life? For everyone else you've told me, you've skipped a bit. And the man says, well, nothing's been done for him. There's no record here of any honour, of any dignity being bestowed upon Mordecai. And so the king said, well, who's in the court? Who's waiting to see me? Who of my princes is here this morning? Remember, it must be early in the morning. The king's trying to get to sleep. Well, Haman's there. He's just come in. He's standing in the outer court. Just the man, the king thinks. He'll know how to honour someone. And so he calls Haman in. And Haman comes in thinking, oh, this is very propitious. The king's actually calling me into his presence. And the king asks, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honour? Oh, isn't Haman pleased? Who else would the king delight to honour more than me? After all, I'm in the queen's good books. The king is no doubt wanting to at least match what the queen is doing for me. And so he proceeds to express his own longing. This is the greatest desire of Haman's heart. Listen to what he wants. He wants to be arrayed in one of the king's robes. He wants to ride on one of the king's horses, wearing a crown. And he wants to be paraded through the streets of Shushan with someone, well, not just anyone, but one of the higher ranking officials or princes in the land of Persia, going before him, shouting out, this is what the king does to those whom he delights to honour. That is Haman's greatest wish. You see where he's going. What Haman would really like is to be sitting on the king's throne. But of course he can't ask for that. So he wants to wear the king's clothes, sit on the king's horse, and be treated like a king. And then here comes the rub. Hurry, the king says. Take the robe and the horse, as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai the Jew. Can you imagine the expression that must have been on Haman's face at that moment? He's been describing what he wants for himself. And afterwards, after he'd been paraded through the city, no doubt he'd have come back and asked to hang Mordecai. And suddenly, there, he hears Mordecai's name. Not in any negative way, but this is the man that the king delights to honour. Mordecai, the Jew who I want to hang. But what can he do? If he refuses the king, it's off with his head. He has to go. Was there any flicker on his face, or was he such a cool customer that the king had no inkling? It's interesting, isn't it, that he obviously didn't know the enmity that Haman had for Mordecai. After all, the king isn't out to humiliate Haman. Haman is one of his best men. He's his right-hand man. He's the prime minister of the Empire of Persia. The king isn't out to humiliate Haman. He has no idea what this act is going to do to Haman. Neither does he have any idea as to how ridiculous this whole thing is going to be. There is Haman. He takes the royal robe and puts it on Mordecai, his sworn enemy. He gets the royal horse with the royal crown on its head. He lifts Mordecai up into the saddle and he proceeds in this procession through the town saying, "This is what the king does to those he delights to honour. And on every street corner and on pinned to every tree is that notice saying that on the 13th day of the 12th month every Jew will be killed." Everyone knows Haman was the designer, the draftsman of that decree. And everyone knows that Mordecai's a Jew. Can you see the ridiculous picture that is being presented here? How humiliated Haman must have felt. I wonder what Mordecai felt. He doesn't expect this honour. He's happily continued his business at the king's gate. We're given no indication that he was ever perturbed by the fact that he hadn't been honoured for saving the king's life. He just got on with his life. And all of a sudden, on this particular morning, he's brought into the king's palace. He's arrayed in the king's robe. He's seated on the king's horse. And off they go on this parade through the city. Was he embarrassed? Did he feel honoured? Did he see the irony of all that was going on? Not that he ever feared for his life. He was convinced that deliverance would come to the Jews. But as he was paraded through those streets, seeing the puzzled expression of Persian and Jew alike, I wonder what thoughts were going through Mordecai's mind. He, no doubt, has no idea at all that his life was on the line that morning, as Haman passed him perhaps, though he probably wasn't in the king's gate that early. And as Haman went and stood in the king's court waiting to be called or waiting for the king to wake up so he could go in, Mordecai would have had no idea that that morning Haman was planning to kill him. But we know, and the writer wants us to know, and to see in these events the amazing work of God. Why was the king sleepless on that morning of all mornings? We're not told that he was given to insomnia. It wasn't something he usually suffered from. This was an unusual event. That night, the king couldn't sleep. So he called for this book to be read out to him. Why did he call for a book to be read out? Why didn't he call for some soothing music to be played that would lull him to sleep? And isn't it incredible that despite the fact it was the normal practice for kings in Persia to honour someone who has done them a favour immediately, that Mordecai hadn't been honoured? And that morning, the king realizes what he's done and what a terrible reflection this is on him. What must have his servants been thinking as they read through this and read of other people that had done the king a favour and had been honoured, and suddenly they just have to pass on? There's no reward, no dignity being bestowed upon this man. What would they have thought? Immediately the king wants to do something. Isn't it incredible that it was that very morning that Mordecai, his favour, his loyalty to the king becomes known again, and that he's honoured in this way? His life literally is saved because of the king's insomnia, because he chooses to read a record from the book of the Chronicles of the Kings, because the passage that is read happens to include Mordecai's actions, and because Mordecai hadn't been honoured when he deserved to have been honoured. God, his hand, his fingerprints are all over these incidents. We never know in our lives what God is doing. And we can become so impatient, can't we? How long, O Lord, is the common cry of the psalmist, which reflects our own cry, doesn't it? How long, O Lord, are you going to leave me in this difficulty? How long, O Lord, are my efforts for you going to be overlooked and remain unrewarded? How long, O Lord, before you do something? But God was doing something. It wasn't neglect on God's part that Mordecai hadn't been honoured earlier. It was all part of God's plan to do it at the right time. What if the king hadn't been sleepless? What if he'd had music instead of a book read to him? What if it had been a different part? So many what ifs, but God's hand is in it all. And we can look and read this story and see it. Mordecai couldn't. He didn't know. He didn't know what a narrow escape he had had. He didn't know all the ways that God was working. But when you read about Mordecai here, you read about a man who trusts in God. What happens after this great honour has been bestowed upon Mordecai? Afterward, Mordecai went back to the king's gate. He doesn't rush home, tell his friends and relatives what a great honour he's received from the king. How at long last, after all these years, the king has recognised his loyalty and rewarded him for saving the king's life. He isn't filled with pride. It isn't now his expectation that everyone should look up to him and so on. No, he just goes back to work. He continues with his life. He remains unfazed by all of this. Level-headed Mordecai, who trusts in the living God, who has confidence in him. But Haman, who woke up with such great hopes that morning, who walked those steps to the king's palace lightheartedly, thinking, now today all my troubles will be over. I'm going to a banquet with the king and the queen, but before that I'll get rid of this Mordecai. Haman's humiliated, not purposefully by the king by any means, but purposefully by God. God's hand is as much in Haman's downfall as it was in Mordecai's preferment. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall, the writer of Proverbs says. And Peter gives this warning: humble yourselves that God may exalt you. And we see that in the lives of these two men. Mordecai went back to work, but Haman. Two significant words. It's always been but Haman, hasn't it? Right from the start, contrasting Esther with Haman, Mordecai with Haman. But Haman hurried to his house mourning, with his head covered. He still gathers his friends around him. His wife, Zeresh, tells them all that has happened to him that day as they sit in the shadow of those gallows that are taller than even the roof of this building. And what do his friends do? Oh, cheer up, Haman. It'll all work out okay. Don't you worry. The king loves you. He wants to honor you. You'll be okay. Oh, no. If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fail, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. It's almost in the tone of, well, we told you so, but they didn't. See how they're distancing themselves now? Oh, things are turning sour for Haman. Let's just back off a bit now. They knew he was a Jew before. Haman had told them, all these honors avail me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. And his wife Zeresh and his friends said, let a gallows be made and hang him on it. Now they're saying, if this Mordecai is of Jewish descent, or we just happen to have forgotten that before. You see, what they do know is this, that when the Jews are being honoured by God, nothing can stand in the way. It's the history of the Jews, isn't it? It's God who punished them. It's God who sent them into captivity. Not another nation who took them into captivity. It's always God's hands at work. And it's interesting that the other nations recognize this. And they see this. And these people know enough about the Jews to know that now things are beginning to turn. The tide's turning. And it's in favor now, not of Haman, but of the Jews. And despite the decree that is written against them, the Jews will prevail. Haman had boasted, oh, the king and I were such good friends. And Haman had great plans. Mordecai the Jew will be hanged, and all the Jews will be obliterated. He had a great ambition. I want to be like the king. But great was his humiliation, parading the man he hated through the streets of Susa. It all adds up to bad news. And so his friends desert him. And everything is turning pear-shaped for poor old Haman. Mordecai's situation is a microcosm of a far bigger picture. God is at work in these pages of Esther. I've said it almost every Sunday that we've been going through this book, because that is the main theme of this book. God is sovereign. And he's sovereign in all the circumstances of our lives. The times when everything seems to be going wrong for us, just as it must have seemed to Mordecai and to Esther and the other Jews in the Empire of Persia, God is at work. And he will show his honour and his glory if we will trust in him. God is working at a far bigger picture than just preferring Mordecai, advancing him, promoting him, raising Esther to her high status in the land of Persia. That's not really what God's concern is. He's concerned about the whole history of redemption, of saving people for himself, a people that he has called out from the world to be his people in a unique way. And that's what this story is set to illustrate for us, is that God is working, and he's working for us. We read earlier from the book of Galatians, from chapter 4. And there's one particular verse that I wanted read because it ties in so well with this. It's Galatians chapter 4 and verse 4, where it said, "When the fullness of the time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons." When the fullness of the time had come. Another way that we could put that is, in God's perfect timing. It was God's perfect timing for Mordecai on that day. Had the timing been any different, Mordecai might have been hanging on those gallows rather than riding on that horse. It was God's perfect timing. And at God's perfect timing, Jesus Christ came into this world. We could look at it from a historical perspective. We could look at the rise and fall of Egypt and of Babylon and of Persia and of the Assyrians and of the Greeks and of the Roman Empire, and see how, in the course of history, how, historically speaking, the timing was perfect for Christ to come and for the spread of the gospel throughout the world. We could look at it from a prophetic perspective and look at the way that, in terms of timings from prophecy, that he came at exactly the right time in order to fulfill exactly the prophecies that had been made concerning the Messiah who was to come. However, whatever angle we look at the coming of Christ, it was at God's perfect timing. How the Jews had longed for the Messiah to come earlier, but it wouldn't have been the right timing. And how the Jews, most of them today, long for the Messiah to come. But they've missed his perfect timing. He has come, and he's done all that he promised to do. God works in his ways, in his time. We must learn from this, that we must be patient, that we must acknowledge God's sovereignty in our lives. As we go about our daily business, as Mordecai did, we do all things to honour and glorify God. We don't understand our circumstances. We don't understand why the history of our lives is unfolding the way that it is. But God knows, and we trust in God. We have confidence in God. We wait patiently upon God to work out his purposes in our lives when we don't see all those things that are going on around us. And God's hand of care guiding us from danger, and his hand of provision giving us all that we need, and his love towards us day by day. But at the same time, we need to take responsibility in our lives. We're not to sit back and let God, as it were. Mordecai, despite his great confidence in the living God, warned Esther, "This is your day. Who knows whether God has raised you and put you in this position for such a time as this?" He took responsibility. He didn't just let go and let God get on with it. He fasted and prayed and called the Jews in Shushan together to fast and pray that Esther would meet with the king's approval. He didn't let go and let God and think, well, God's sovereign, he'll do it, he'll sort it all out, doesn't need my help. Well, God doesn't need my help. He doesn't need your help, but he does expect you to live responsibly. And so, yes, we have patience in God to work out his purposes, but at the same time, we act responsibly, obeying all the Lord's commands, living our lives for him, seeking to glorify God, opposing evil, pursuing that which is good, and all the time having confidence in the God who will judge the wicked and reward the righteous in his time, not in ours. Mordecai knew how God worked, had confidence in a sovereign God. And so he went back to work. Went back to his daily routine, knowing deliverance would yet come to the Jews, completely ignorant of his own deliverance that day. We must live the same way. We don't know what great things God has done for us, even this day, in preserving us and protecting us. We must be confident that God is preserving us and protecting us, and live for him.